Hello and welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm your sometime host, Baron Soka. Ash is in Russia still. We don't know if she's ever coming back, but we hope so. We miss her. And with me in the studio today is Jim Dunstan. Jim is our favorite space lawyer, an adjunct fellow at Tech Freedom, and my longtime mentor. Jim has been on the show several times. He did a three-part intro to space law last year, which we will link to in the show notes. Jim, thanks for coming.
It's great to be back doing this.
And so you're really a space lawyer?
I'm really a space lawyer.
You get that a lot at parties, right?
Yes. Yes, I'm a walking, talking space lawyer, yes.
So when people ask you about space law, where do you usually go with that?
Well, after about four words, their eyes usually roll back in their heads and I just stop at that
point.
Are
those four, let me guess, it's the Outer Space Treaty of, you don't even get to 1967, they tune out at of. Well, we're not going to talk about the Outer Space Treaty today, I think.
I doubt it.
Okay, good. So this is not a Space Law 101. This is a Space Law as applied class. And we're going to be talking today about the latest exciting development in satellites, something that's never happened before. So satellite business been around for a long time. We've had satellites in orbit since Sputnik and communication satellites for a long time. Commercial satellite business, they go through a licensing process at the FCC. The International Telecommunications Union coordinates that use of spectrum across countries, and that generally goes pretty smoothly. Maybe a little few hiccups here and there, but we all know how that works. Until what? What just happened?
So what happened over the last couple of weeks is that the magazine IEEE Spectrum released an article in which it pointed out that the FCC, for the first time, as far as they know, and as far as I know from my 35-year career, denied an experimental license application to a satellite operator on the grounds that the satellite that they were going to launch was so small that it couldn't be tracked. However, the satellites were nonetheless launched by an Indian rocket back in December. And so this really tees up an interesting question of, well, the FCC said no, they went ahead and launched anyway. How much trouble are they in? And the evidence that they're in a great deal of trouble is the fact that they had another experimental license that had been granted by the FCC. And the FCC sent them an email setting it aside and saying that the FCC is beginning an investigation to determine whether or not they're fit to be an FCC licensee.
That sounds bad.
That's the equivalent of going for the death penalty at the FCC, because if you are found to not be fit to hold an FCC license, you will never get another FCC license. And for a company like this that has to rely on authority from the FCC to downlink communications, you're done. Your business is over.
Dead.
D-E-D.
D-E-D, dead.
Yes.
Okay, well, let's back up a step. So just remind us all, if they're launching on an Indian launcher, why do they have to get a license from the FCC?
Because they wanted to downlink into the United States. If this is an experimental license, this is for an Internet of Things constellation of satellites that are really, really small. Their operational satellites are going to be what are known as 1U CubeSats, or 10 centimeters on a side, 2.5 inches by 2.5 inches. The ones that they actually launched, the four, were 1/4 that size. So they were an inch by 2.5 inches per side. And so these are really, really small satellites. But their experiment was going to be to determine whether a satellite this small could actually, what's known as close the link budget, could communicate up and down from space so that they could do machine data, Internet of Things type of things. So they really needed authority from the FCC to conduct their experiment, because anytime you're going to downlink into the United States, you got to get permission from the FCC.
So I'm picturing like fudge, you know, you slice it up 1-inch cubic inch pieces, right?
About the size of a deck of cards is what we're talking here.
But it's not called fudge set. It's called...
This is called Space Bees. Yes, that's what because the name of the company is Swarm Technologies.
I see what they did there.
Yes, yes. And they're a Silicon Valley startup, a couple of ex-Google folks. And they've been, pun intended, flying under the radar for quite some time. And they went to the FCC and said, give us this experimental license. And the FCC said no.
Okay, so these are not like the geostationary satellites that orbit in one place. These are in a much lower orbit. They're going to provide service to multiple countries, so they need a license from the U.S., probably from other countries to provide service.
Right. They're going to need authorization to what's known as land to downlink into every country that they're operating in.
And if the U.S. says no, they're going to be toast elsewhere.
Yes. And given that Internet of Things is really going to be driven by the developed countries and the United States in particular, if they can't do business here in the United States, you know, they're a goner. They're just fine. So we'll fold up their tent and go home.
Okay. So the issue is size. So what's the problem? If it's a small satellite, shouldn't that be less of a problem?
Well, in one sense, it's less of a problem. Now, we're talking obviously about orbital debris here. The fact that there's lots of stuff flying around at 17,000 miles per hour. And if stuff runs into each other, there's a lot of kinetic energy, lots of damage can be done. And so having a smaller satellite...
Bullets are pretty small. You don't have to be big to do a lot of damage.
Yes. And they travel very slowly compared to what these guys are traveling at. But in orbital debris mechanics, the smaller your cross-section, the smaller the satellite is, the less likelihood that you're going to run into something else. The bigger it is, the higher the likelihood that something's going to run into you. So that's one side of the equation. But the other side of the equation is we currently track about 13,000 objects, only about 4,000 to 5,000 of which are operational. Most of it's space junk, but
pieces of launch vehicles,
pieces of launch vehicle, dead satellites that were launched. I mean, there are, and those are the ones that we track.
And the occasional Tesla.
And the occasional Tesla going by. Yes. But that's what we track, 13,000. They anticipate that there may be somewhere between 250,000 and a million different pieces of stuff. I mean, back in the late, in the early 60s, we launched 100,000 space needles into orbit, many of which still are up there.
That was probably a bad idea, right?
That was a really, really bad idea. The concept was if you had this mesh of needles, you could then you could bounce radio waves off of them. And so you could communicate off of bouncing off of these needles. Some really, really harebrained idea that...
And just to be clear, some of this stuff burns up pretty quickly. It's in a low orbit.
Right.
Some of the stuff is in a much higher orbit, can stay there for a really long time, and some of it's never coming down ever.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And where's Swarm launching?
So Swarm's going into, I think, about 500 kilometer polar orbit. So it's going over the poles, but it's still pretty low at 500 kilometers.
So how long will the stuff stay up there?
So they told the FCC, that according to their calculations, the nominal orbital life would be about 7 years. So somewhere between 5 and 9 years, they think that it'll come down. But the FCC's real problem here is the fact that they can't track it. These satellites are so small that the apertures, that the granularity of the current system only goes down to 10 centimeters on a side. And because these satellites are 1/4 that size, the FCC said, we can't track you. Therefore, we can't, it's not we in this case, it's the people who do the tracking, aren't going to be able to warn other satellites. So on that basis, we are denying your satellite or denying your experimental license. But there's a problem in that fact that there isn't any rule that the FCC can point to that says the minimum satellite which you can launch is one CubeSat.
Because no one's ever done this before.
Because no one's ever done this before.
So normally, satellites are big. We've had this movement towards CubeSats
right.
in recent years. But how big is a typical CubeSat?
So a typical CubeSat is usually what's known as either a 3U or a 6U. And so a 3U CubeSat is...
I thought one of me was enough.
Yes. 3U is one CubeSat, 10 centimeters, stacked, three of them stacked together. Okay, so that's what's known as a 3U. Then there's a 6U, which is two rows of three. So six of these 1Us put together. And that then gets you, up to something up slightly larger than a loaf of bread for a 3U or a 6U.
Okay, so we're talking how many centimeters in those cases?
So that would be 30 by 20 by 10 would be a 6U.
Right. And here we're talking about something that's really small.
One quarter by one by one. Yeah. So again, a deck of cards is the size of this thing.
So the FCC notes this and they say, well, we don't have an ability to track objects smaller than 10 centimeters cubed. And therefore this is not in the public interest. So if they don't have a rule on file, two questions. One, do they need a rule on file? And two, what would they point to in the absence of a rule?
So I think what they would point to, if pressed on this, is in applying for an experimental license, you have to file what's known as an orbital debris mitigation statement. And you have to, and there is a rule that says you have to do that. And as part of that rule, you have to explain to the FCC why your satellite isn't going to be a cause of debris and isn't going to pose a danger to other satellites. And I'm sure what they would say is they would point to that rule 5.63 or 5.64 of the FCC's rules and say, you can't prove to us that you're not going to be a danger to other satellites because we don't even know where you are. And so if pressed, I think that they would do that.
Now, so the size is just one way that that could be true.
Yes, yes.
Did they submit a plan, a debris mitigation plan?
Yes, they did. It's not all that detailed, but it was there. And what they said was, well, we've got a radar reflecting coating, which should help. And actually,
who doesn't?
Yeah, who these doesn't? Days. Exactly. And it should, in fact, make our satellite look bigger than it is. And they've got an operational radio beacon that beeps to tell people. And so they said, well, these are the two ways that you can track us. And the FCC came back and said, well, your radio beacon is only going to work so long as your satellite works. If the satellite dies, that's going off. And we're not convinced that this whole radar reflecting coding thing is going to work. And so we're just going strictly by the size here.
And then just a sidebar here. So once they got that denial, This is after they've already launched?
No, this is before they launched. Oops. This is why they're in trouble. So they got that denial in December, and they were launched in January. However, either be right before or right after the denial, they had already delivered the satellites to their spacecraft integrator, a company called Spaceflight out of Seattle, who then packaged these four little satellites in with 20 other still fairly little satellites into a big fairing and shipped everything off to India and then integrated it on the launch vehicle there. So one of the things that Swarm may come back and say to the commission is our hands are tied under contractually. We had to deliver these things in order to be integrated. Otherwise we would have missed the launch. Now the FCC's response is, well, that's your tough luck. You should have not delivered it without an experimental license in hand. Meanwhile, Spaceflight, the integrator, is pointing the finger back at Swarm, saying we relied on them to get the license. And then the Indian government is pointing their finger back and say, you know, we were assured that everybody on that launch had the necessary authority. Because one of Swarm's arguments could be that well, we've got authority because the Indian government agreed to launch us. And so long as we don't turn the radios on, now we're not in violation of FCC law.
Well, this seems to me to be the critical point. The FCC doesn't issue launch licenses.
That's right.
Right? So whatever we said we weren't going to talk about the Outer Space Treaty, and here we are. The Outer Space Treaty requires authorization and ongoing supervision from the launching state. So when you launch something, you can't just do it with no permission at all. Some state has to have some system for authorizing that. And here, it could have been the U.S., could have been any number of countries. They went to India. That launch presumably was licensed by the Indian government. It went up, compliant with the Outer Space Treaty. There's no payload international requirement for getting an approval of payload except to use the frequencies.
That's right.
And so here's the conundrum, right? Because they've got the stuff up there and the FCC's hook, the whole orbital debris mitigation plan for the FCC is all contingent on this company needing to turn on their satellites and use those frequencies to communicate with the US when they fly over.
That's right.
And if they don't do that, what do they need from the FCC? I mean, it's bad. They can't turn them on, but they haven't technically violated U.S. law, right? Maybe?
Yes, maybe, maybe no, because it is a U.S. payload. Presumably, it didn't go under a payload review from the FAA-AST.
The plot thickens.
Because it's a communications satellite, it didn't have to go through ITAR for export controls.
International Traffic in Arms Regulations.
And so there's a real question as to on what authority was this satellite ever delivered to a foreign country to launch it?
Okay, so let's just make sure we're clear on this. So does the FAA always have to do a payload determination review before I launch a payload on a foreign country's? Well, then why would they have to do it here?
Well, because if you don't, if the FAA doesn't do it, somebody has to do it.
And but the Indian government, did they not do some?
Well, we don't know. We don't know exactly what the process is in India. All they've stated on the record is we were told that all of these satellites had approval of their countries before they were launched.
Right. Just like Facebook was told that the Cambridge Analytica data had been deleted. Right. In other words, there's a kind of a question here about what's the duty to scrutinize what someone in your supply chain tells you.
And what complicates things here is there are at least five different sets of orbital debris mitigation regulations floating around in the United States.
So to speak.
Yeah. So
running into each other occasionally.
Yes. Bumping into each other.
And that's
colliding.
Why are there five?
Well, okay. So we have the FCC's rules that we're talking about here. And that's if you want to use frequencies.
Which you need to.
Right. Which
frequently.
Then we've got the FAA's regulations.
For the launch license.
For the launch license and for payload reviews that they do. Then you've got NOAA's for remote sensing. So if I want to get a remote sensing license from NOAA, I have to demonstrate that I'm compliant with their debris mitigation regulations, which all are slightly different, by the way. And then you've got NASA, so if you're dealing with NASA, you've got to comply with theirs. And then DOD has its own set. So there's five different sets. One of the things that the National Space Council is suggesting is to do away with this more than duplicative regulatory scheme and consolidate.
Quintuplicative.
Yes. Quintuplicative. That's tripping me off the tongue. And in fact, consolidate all of the review of orbital debris into the Commerce Department and have them do all of that and strip the FCC out of there because it really doesn't make sense. I mean, the FCC engineers are frequency engineers. They're not orbital mechanics engineers, they don't know better than anybody else the probability that two things are going to go bump in the night in space. And so why should the FCC have this jurisdiction? So going forward, and in fact, this may be one of those forcing function cases that may bring light on the fact that maybe the FCC isn't the best place to do this, and certainly not the best place to do it without more significant rules than they currently have.
And the current rules, you've mentioned these a few times, where did those come from? How long have those been on the books?
So the FCC's rules on orbital debris mitigation were adopted in 2004. And so they've been around, 14 years now. But in 2004, nobody could have predicted what we're seeing now, which is the CubeSat revolution of having these really small satellites up there. And so the FCC has always been dealing with these gigantic geosats or, slightly smaller, but still as big as this room, LEO satellites. And so they've never been confronted with the issues that are now coming to the fore with the CubeSat revolution. Everything from the fact that the FCC considers it's going to be 3 to 5 years from the time you first walk into the door and tell them that you want to launch a satellite until you do it, as opposed to today, you can go from a blank sheet of paper to launch within 6 months. And so that's one of the processes that's really putting a strain on the regulatory system right now. But this whole size thing is really, really going to heat up and be very interesting.
Okay, so if you were a lawmaker, not that you would want to be, but if you were a lawmaker, how would you deal with this?
I think the National Space Council is right. We do need to consolidate orbital debris mitigation and remediation into a single agency. It just makes no sense to have it.
But that's only part of it. That's an administrative question of who issues the license. I mean, you noted earlier that the orbital debris mitigation plans don't necessarily say much. I mean, it strikes me this is a little bit like in data security, right? You could have prescriptive regulations, you could have a standard by which you judge things, or you could require companies to publish their plan. What's their terms of service? What are their privacy principles? How do they deal with data security? Right. There's always going to be a mix of those things. And you could have a multi-stakeholder program where industry comes together and says, we're going to set standards. And here's one set of standard for this particular class of service. And maybe the small sets could come up with their own standard. You could imagine those things being approved by a regulator. What, in other words, there are multiple models here. What's the right model for dealing with this?
Well, I think the wrong model is the current model, which is pour your guts out to us and tell us why you're not a bad actor, and then we'll grant your application against virtually no standards. The only standards that are out there is you have to demonstrate that the likelihood is that your satellite will deorbit itself within 25 years, the so-called 25-year rule.
Strange name for a rule.
Yeah, strange name for a rule.
That involves 25 years.
Involves 25 years. Somebody came up with that rule back in the late 80s, early 90s. The idea was that if space can self-scrub itself over 25 years, then we'll be okay. But that was based on the launch cadence of the late 80s and early 90s when we were launching a dozen satellites a year. I mean, SpaceX just this week is asking for 1,200 additional satellites for its constellation.
And in different orbits, they will deorbit in different periods.
Right. And so the 25-year rule has to be questioned right now.
It's almost like you're saying we need evidence-based rulemaking.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Appropriate to the particular context of the issue. So I can imagine, Congress could say to the Department of Commerce that you should suddenly spin up this dormant Office of Space Commerce that has really, been inactive since the 90s?
Late 80s.
Yeah. Oh, well, okay. So spin that up out of nowhere, hire the right people, do some kind of rulemaking based on this standard. I mean, that's a big undertaking. I would think there's going to be a lot of inertia to just say, well, why don't we just have the FAA do it? And why should we change the plan significantly? Do you fear that we just wind up with another kludge onto the system where we just add on another kind of module?
Yeah, I guess it's whether or not you want something that's practical or something that makes sense. It might be practical to put it at FAA and have them do it, but does it make sense? I mean, the FAA is there to license launches. They're not.
And promote the launch industry.
And promote the launch industry. But them doing payload reviews in the first instance, I've always thought is a bit of a stretch of their of their jurisdiction.
So you'd move that part over to
Commerce. I'd move that over to Commerce as well.
So in other words, we're not so much talking about a new office. We're more talking about splitting up this function inside the Office of Commercial Space Transportation at the FAA. Right, you take some of those people, perhaps some of that capability.
So here's the other problem of keeping it, the practical problem of keeping it at the FAA, is the FAA is notoriously slow in doing the rulemakings. You and I deal with the FCC all the time, and we talk about how long it takes a rulemaking to get through the FCC. They are Indianapolis 500 speed compared to the FAA's rulemakings. The FCC, generally a year, 2 years, you can get something done. FAA rulemakings are 4, 5, 6 years. The National Space Council asked the FAA how long they thought it would take to change their launch rules that govern commercial launches, which are, again, based in the 1980s. And the FAA reported back to the National Space Council 5 to 7 years. And which point the vice president said, you got a year to do it. So the FAA is not equipped to run the sort of rulemakings that we see, again, at the FCC. They're used to doing that. They've got procedures. That's not what the FAA's business is doing. And so putting all that, essentially telling the FAA, okay, now you need to gear up to do something you don't do very well, which is rulemaking, to come up with these standards, I don't think that's a good idea. That's why I've always sort of been, let's give a blank sheet of paper over to Commerce, Department of Commerce, because they're supposed to promote commercial interests as well. So why not start fresh over there?
Yeah, well, you're placing a lot of trust in what would essentially be a new agency, and giving them a blank sheet of paper, it would be up to Congress to put in some safeguards. Hopefully we'd have some economic analysis here to guide what's the trade-off, right? These are ultimately economic questions. You know, how, what's the risk on the one hand of collision versus the utility? On the other hand, consumers ultimately will suffer if the government gets it wrong, if they're right. too cautious. But let's wrap up by talking about a particular example of that, because we've seen a little bit of this playing out recently with satellites. There were four incidents last year where satellites that were near or beyond their intended 15-year operational life, they got an extension from the FCC to continue operating them. And I think in all four cases, they didn't have the ability to safely deorbit themselves if something went wrong. And there were four different incidents. So what tell us about those and what does that say about the current approach and how we might be getting it wrong?
Yeah. And so what I think it says is on the one hand, we have this case here, a new startup trying to do something very innovative and the FCC saying no, because you're so small that we think you may pose a hazard. And then on the other hand, these really two generations ago satellites that were launched in the 90s, which had 10-year licenses come in and they were extended by the FCC. And now they're coming back and saying, extend them again. Give us out till, 25 years from launch, 10 years beyond the design life of these satellites. Because why? Because we're still making a ton of money off of
these
things.
And the risk here is the longer they operate them, the more likely it is that the satellite just clunks out right. and then can't be moved out of that orbit into somewhere where it's not going to damage other people's satellites.
Exactly. You just run the risk with every single day beyond the operational life that's going to be the day that something goes wrong. And if that something goes wrong, keeps the satellite operator from being able to deorbit it. And remember, in GEO, it's not really a deorbit. What they do is they kick it up into a graveyard orbit that's going to keep it there for 1,000 years before it starts sliding back down. But if something goes wrong, you lose telemetry, your radios go bad, electronics get fried, something like that, then you can no longer, it then becomes a piece of junk in that highly valuable GEO orbit. And as you said, pointed out, four instances last year of satellites either being lost or nearly being lost at a time when they were asking the FCC to extend out their licenses. So it's a bit of a, I'm not going to say hypocrisy, but it's a bit of a strange approach to say we're going to just keep extending out all these old satellites because they're still making money. We're not going to let people do innovative things.
So what do you think explains the disconnect between that approach, where there's this one office at the FCC, the International Bureau, that makes those decisions, versus Chairman Pai has talked for years about having more economic analysis in what the agency does. We just did an episode with Rosin Layton about that topic and how the agency is standing up this Office of Economics and Analytics to study these questions better. But that's just getting started. Do you think that it's just going to take time for the agency to start to think of topics like this in economic terms? Or is there a particular reason why it's hard to do that here?
Well, I think you have to understand where that office is coming from. I mean, it's highly engineering driven.
The frequency existing engineers, international
the
bureau.
Existing international bureau. They're a bunch of engineers. And so they're looking at these things and saying, well, hey, this satellite's been working fine. It's still got enough fuel. Yes, it's beyond its design life, but everybody knows that you undersell the actual life of a piece of electronics so that if it goes bad early, you can say, well, its design life was only 10 years. And so if it goes bad in 9.5 years, you almost hit your mark, as opposed to you really designed it to last 15 or 20 years, but you market it as something less. And frankly, that's what's happening is the satellite operators are coming in and kind of winking at the FCC and say, hey, yeah, maybe it only had a 15-year design life, but this thing's rock solid. It's still got plenty of fuel. It's gonna last another 10, 15 years.
And there's no model for assessing those claims. And there's no legal standard because there's no statute that governs this. It's just the agency had a rulemaking and said, you got to have an orbital debris mitigation plan. You got that. And then they kind of figure this out case by case as they go. So, I think that's it for today. Any final thoughts on all this?
No, I think this is one of those podcasts where we don't necessarily have all the answers to these, but it's such an interesting and fascinating question that we really need to talk about it. And we especially need to talk about it because we have so many startups and entrepreneurs now being interested in space and wanting to do stuff in space. And that same sort of Silicon Valley, brash, let's push the envelope on rules, doesn't necessarily work when you get into a regulated industry like the satellite industry. And so one of the things I think we're going to need to see is a coalition of these small sat operators kind of coming together and banding and realizing that they've got to interface with Washington, D.C. now, because as these guys as Swarm is going to see, they may not be able to ask for forgiveness at this point. If the FCC may just bring the hammer down on them. And so it would have been a lot better for them to have sought good advice going in as opposed to asking for forgiveness later. Yeah,
and it sounds like they and everyone else, especially the big operators that have these really valuable assets that provide service to everyone every day, they would all be better off if there were more legal certainty here, if we had a framework that was predictable, that wasn't overly burdensome. It didn't have them deorbit things that were useful. It balanced those risks well, but wasn't so arbitrary, wasn't so easily gamed, which is kind of our general narrative here, that how you craft laws matters, who enforces them matters. Jim, we'll have you back on the show when those satellites start coming down from those graveyard orbits in 1,000 years. And you can say, I told you so, and we can talk about what happens then and who's legally responsible for dealing with that.
I'll freeze my head tonight. Okay.
Or if you're watching Altered Carbon, we could just put you in a new skin. We freeze you, put you in a new skin when that comes out, and get you right back on the Tech Policy Podcast.
All right.
By which time, I'm sure everyone in the audience will have left a review. We've been asking you to do that. 1,000 years should be more than enough time to do so. I hope it's 5 stars, but I'll see what happens in 1,000 years. So please do that. You can find the show on Facebook and Twitter. Feel free to share it with your friends. The police are coming to shut us down as we speak. So I'm going to wrap it up there. Jim, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Baird.
Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.